And a good Monday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X. Don't forget that you can listen to the show and take it on demand with you 24/7 by checking out the Nick Craig Show in your favorite podcast app. You can also head on over to the website, nickcraig.com, and listen there as well. And as always, of course, catching the show live 7 a.m. on our YouTube, Rumble, Facebook, and X streams. Our show this morning is brought to you in part by The Law Group. Visit them online at lawgroupnc.com or give them a call at 910-251-6088. Well, President Donald Trump this morning continues his tour over in parts of Europe. He has got a 5-day tour that he's in the middle of right now over in Scotland. And with that, expecting some major announcements from the United States as we are getting ever closer to August the 1st. That is coming up Friday, with many of the trade pauses and some of the deadlines for trade deals set to go into effect starting on August the 1st. So after months of negotiations, the announcement came out yesterday that the president had struck a trade deal, that the United States had officially struck a trade deal with the European Union. This was announced yesterday alongside European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen in Scotland. And we'll get into some of those details, but let's just listen to a few minutes of this announcement yesterday as Trump unveils this major European trade deal. Let's take a listen.
Probably the biggest deal ever reached in any capacity, trade or beyond trade.
It is.
It's a giant deal with lots of countries, because, as you know, Ursula represents a lot of countries, not one country. It's not easy for you. It's because a lot of very different countries, great countries. But some are strong with cars, some are strong with agriculture, some are strong with both, right? You have a lot of different factors. So we're going to do the following. The European Union is going to agree to purchase from the United States $750 billion worth of energy, $750 billion worth of energy. They are going to agree to invest into the United States $600 billion more than they're investing already. So they're investing a large amount of money. You know what that amount of money is. It's very substantial. But they're going to invest an additional $600 billion. They're agreeing to open up their countries to trade at zero tariff. So that's a very big factor. Opening up their countries, all of the countries will be opened up to trade with the United States at zero tariff. And they're agreeing to purchase a vast amount of military equipment. We don't know what that number is, but it's the good news is we make the best military equipment in the world, so sort of you have to do that. I mean, till somebody tops us, which is not going to happen. We're way ahead of every other country in terms of the quality of the military equipment. You saw that recently in Iran, and you see that. Unfortunately, you see that often for all the wrong reasons, right? So those things are $750 billion, $600 billion, opening up the country. We are agreeing that the tariff straight across for automobiles and everything else will be a straight across tariff of 15%. So we have a tariff of 15%. We have the opening up of all of the European countries, which I think I could say were essentially closed. I mean, you weren't exactly taking our autos. You weren't exactly taking our agriculture. And then you would have smaller things. But for the most part, it was closed. And now it's open. It's open for our companies to go in and do a good job with it. I think you'll like them. I think you'll like it. And we will, very importantly, they'll be investing a lot of money. But the military is a big number. But that's one number we're not determining. It's going to be whatever it is. But they're going to be purchasing hundreds of billions of dollars worth of military equipment. They're very important. They're going to purchase $750 billion worth of energy. So that's going to be great. and $600 billion worth of investments into the United States over and above what they have. So, and I think that basically concludes the deal. I mean, those are the main factors. I don't think there are too many other factors, other than we're going to get along great. And we have a great relationship now with NATO, which is largely the same. I mean, not exactly, but pretty close, right? Largely. And with NATO, as you know, they're going up to 5% from 2%. And the relationship is very strong with NATO. So I just want to congratulate you. I think it's great that we made a deal today instead of playing games and maybe not making a deal at all. I think it's I'm going to let you say, but I think it's the biggest deal ever made. Thank you very much.
Thank
Congratulations.
So we'll get into the comments that here in just a second from the president of the European Union. That is a 27-member bloc, the EU that exists, well, of course, in parts of Europe. And this has been one of the higher items of priority from the administration as these trade negotiations, as these trade deals have unfolded over the last couple of months. You've got a large group of countries in the European Union that make an incredible amount of product that the United States buys a lot of, imports a lot of. And so striking this deal with the EU is a major, major win for the United States. And just looking at a chart here of, you know, what the European Union is, you're talking about countries like Spain, Italy, France, Germany, Poland, Sweden, Finland. And these are some of the larger countries. Ireland, of course, on that list as well. So it is a large 27-member bloc. Of course, the United Kingdom is not part of that. As we are on the air this morning, President Donald Trump, again, is over in Scotland right now. So the time difference, and he is set to meet with the British Prime Minister coming up here. All reports are soon. If anything live happens while we're on the air, we'll see if we can dip into any of that coverage as the president continues. Also noting that they are close to a trade deal with China. Again, all of this ahead of this August the 1st deadline, which is coming up here on Friday for the United States and for many of these other countries across the world as the as that date gets closer and as these increased tariffs would go into effect. Some interesting commentary coming in on our Rumble live chat this morning. So many countries will now have our best military equipment that will probably be used against us one day. Arm the enemy. You know, it's an interesting point. You know, I think when you're talking about the European Union, I don't know that I would look at any of these countries and say that they will be using our military equipment against us one day. I mean, obviously that is something to be mindful of, something definitely to keep in the back of your mind. But I can't imagine that countries, you know, you look at the map and you look at the scope and the size of a France or a Germany or a Romania or an Italy. I don't think that you're going to see a military offensive against the United States from these countries. But there is, of course, the concern that, you know, those arms, those munitions could be sold off to other entities that do not have the United States' best interests in mind or in heart. So that's a very good point. I appreciate you bringing that up on our Rumble live chat this morning. Definitely something to keep in the back of your mind. So we heard from President Trump. Now we'll turn it over to the president of the European Union and her thoughts on this announcement, this major trade deal between the United States and the EU.
Thank you. We have a deal. We have a trade deal between the two largest economies in the world. And it's a big deal. It's a huge deal. It will bring stability. It will bring predictability. That's very important for our businesses on both sides of the Atlantic. It's 15% tariffs across the board, all inclusive. The investments Mr. President just described that are going to go to the United States and the purchases over there. Indeed, basically, the European market is open. It's 450 million people. So it's a good deal. It's a huge deal.
Yeah.
Was tough negotiations. I knew it at the beginning, and it was indeed very tough, but we came to a good conclusion for both sides.
Now, I'm going to stop her right there. This is a part that cannot be underscored, and it really is one of the key differences between somebody like Donald Trump and Joe Biden. You're hearing directly from the president of the European Union, Ursula von der Leyen. And she is saying publicly, it's similar commentary that you heard from the head of NATO. These negotiations were tough. We knew these negotiations were tough. A lot went into these tough negotiations. Now, I'm not going to relitigate this morning the discussion over tariffs. I still am of the mindset that long term, that, you know, I don't believe that these are necessarily going to be hugely beneficial to the United States. In the short term, I think it will have major economic pressure on the American people. We're not getting into that this morning. This is what the president, this is what the administration is doing. I've made my stance pretty clear on that, and I think a lot of other folks have as well. But as we go down this road and as this process continues, I think the question that a lot of folks should be asking themselves is, do you want a tough negotiator in the White House or not? And we have heard time and time again from world leaders literally all over the world, case in point, world leaders, that these negotiations have been very tough with the administration. I want that in my president. And I'm going to say, regardless of whether they're a Democrat or a Republican, now obviously I'd prefer to have a Republican in the Oval Office, but I want the commander-in-chief, I want the president of the United States to be a strong and tough negotiator. I want him or her to be somebody that goes over to, you know, Europe, goes over to Belgium, or goes to the NATO summit in The Hague, goes over there and expresses American strength and therefore is negotiating tough on behalf of the United States, trying to make the best deal possible, not only for the United States government, but of course for the people of our country. And it really is a stark difference between what you had for the past 4 years and what you've got now. Did you ever hear any world leader describe Joe Biden as a tough negotiator? I mean, he traveled all over the world too. He made his trips all over the place, as you do as president of the United States. Did you ever hear those comments? Do you remember hearing over and over again that, you know, Joe Biden is a tough negotiator? That Joe Biden was doing was coming to the table, was bringing forth, you know, tough bare knuckle negotiation? No, you didn't, because it wasn't true, because it wasn't happening. You've heard now, just in the last couple of weeks, from the head of NATO, now the head of the European Union, how tough these negotiations are. And it really comes down to, I think, one of the major reasons why you saw success, or why Donald Trump saw success in November. People want a strong leader. People want somebody in the Oval Office that is going to advocate for the United States of America, is not going to bend themselves into a pretzel at the will of foreign entities that don't have the United States' best interests at heart. And let me be clear with this. The European Union should not have the United States' best interests in mind. The European Union should be worried about the European Union. Great Britain should not have the United States as their top priority. They should have their own people and their own country as their top priority. That is what you want in a leader. So I'm not offended. I don't take offense to the fact that these countries are not always looking out for the United States' best interests. And that's why it is so key. That's why it is so important to have a strong negotiator, a strong leader in the Oval Office. And say what you want about Donald Trump, whether you like his policies, hate his policies, think that tariffs are a good deal, not a good deal, bad for the U.S., good for the U.S., irregardless of what you think of the policies at hand, I think you'd be hard-pressed to make a salient argument as to why President Donald Trump is a weak leader. I think you'd be hard pressed to convince yourself or others that Donald Trump is not a strong negotiator. And the fruits of the labor of him being a strong negotiator are deals like this, are the fact that NATO and the NATO member countries are now upping all of their all of their investment into NATO to 5% of their country's GDP. That would not have happened without a strong negotiator in the Oval Office. That would not have happened without somebody. And again, it doesn't have to be just Trump. This is not exclusively a Donald Trump thing. This is the difference between strong leadership and weak leadership. The American people over the last 4 years witnessed what the results of weak leadership looks like. The United States gets steamrolled on the national stage by foreign countries because they know they have the upper hand. Russia invades Ukraine because they know that the United States isn't going to do really a whole hell of a lot about it. Countries feel that they're employed to do whatever the hell they want because they don't really have to worry about the United States smacking down the hammer on them. That's the difference between strong and weak leadership. And I'm strongly of the mindset that the American people watched this unfold, watched this leadership fail at the national level over the last 4 years, and they wanted a change, even if they didn't love Donald Trump's policies. You should want a strong executive in the Oval Office. You should want somebody that is out there pumping their chest for America all over the world. That doesn't make you an isolationist. That doesn't make you somebody that, oh, well, we don't want to do deals with any. No, you want to do deals. But you need to come at these deals from a place of American strength, not a place of American weakness. And I think when you look at the slogan MAGA, Make America Great Again, right? This is, I think, part of that strategy. And it really exemplifies what that means. Going to the European Union, going to China, going to NATO, and telling these, whether it's, you know, this conglomerate of countries like NATO is, or the EU, or our largest trade partner in China or Mexico or Canada, whatever the case may be, going there and saying, we are going to advocate strongly for the United States. We are not going to be ran over by other countries, by NATO, by the European Union. We're not going to be run over by you guys anymore. We're going to advocate for America first. That doesn't mean NATO, EU, Canada, Mexico. That doesn't mean China and all those places last, but it means our top priority is America. And I really think that's an important thing to understand as you watch these negotiations unfold, as you watch these deals be made. That's a very key portion of all of this, is exemplifying and expressing American strength and American negotiation on the national stage. Back to the press conference from yesterday between Donald Trump and the president of EU.
So again, congratulations and many thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions?
How did you come to a deal so quickly? Did the European Union come there again?
I think we both wanted to make a deal. You said something that is very important. It's going to bring us closer together. I think this deal will bring us very close together, actually. Sort of, it's a partnership in a sense, but it's a very good point, and it's something that's very important.
But was there one issue that we need to get over the hurdle?
No. We had four or five. No, not pharmaceuticals. I mean, we're going to be, as you know, a lot of companies are coming into the U.S., and that's unrelated to this deal. But it's, I think this didn't just start today. We had a meeting. I wasn't sure. I said 50-50. I think you probably felt the same thing. But this started months ago, this negotiation. So we knew pretty much what we were getting into. And we were able to make a deal that's very satisfactory to both sides. So it's a very powerful deal. It's a very big deal. It's the biggest of all the deals. It will be the biggest of all the deals. So we're very honored to have done so. And your staff has been fantastic. Yep. And they worked together long and hard.
They worked hard and long, and many thanks to the teams on both sides. There was, as I said at the beginning, a heavy lifting you had to do. But Many thanks also for the talks we had many times on the way to our goal. And now we made it. And that's good. That's really good.
Anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
I have a question for the EU Commission President. What are the U.S. concessions? What is the U.S. giving up in the deal, if anything?
So as the starting point was an imbalance, a surplus on our side and a deficit on the U.S. side. And we wanted to rebalance the trade relation. And we wanted to do it in a way that trade goes on between the two of us across the Atlantic, because the two biggest economies should have a good trade flow between us. And I think we hit exactly the point we wanted to find. Rebalance, but enable trade on both sides, which means good jobs on both sides of the Atlantic, means prosperity on both sides of the Atlantic, and that was important for us.
And again, the energy is a very important component, because we have more energy than anybody else in that sense. And I think it was very wise that they buy a lot of energy, and it's great stuff, and it solves a lot of problems. So that was a great decision, I think.
What about steel? What
on what?
Steel.
Steel is staying the way it is. The steel and aluminum, et cetera, et cetera. That's a worldwide thing. That stays the way it is.
We have chips. Did you discuss that as far as the agreement? Chips?
Chips is, Howard, you might want to describe the chips, please, if you would.
Well, the expectation is in 2 weeks' time, we're going to come out with our chips 232. And that was one of the key reasons that the European Union came to talk to the president to try to resolve all things at one time. And well, I'll let you wait for the 2 weeks until you get to announce your plan. But we are going to be bringing chip manufacturing back to the United States of America.
We'll be doing a lot of chips. A lot of companies are coming in from Taiwan and from other places into the U.S. And they're doing that in order to avoid tariffs. And the president really avoided the tariffs in a better way for them, much better way, much more conclusive. I think probably much more profitable, definitely much more profitable, and got a lot of benefit from it. So it was a very interesting negotiation. I think it's going to be great for both parties. I think your various countries are very happy about this.
Is there an industry in the U.S. that you see maybe having the first impact of getting into this market that was not accessible before, whether it's auto? What's the first call you made?
Yeah, I think cars. Cars basically were not invited, were not, I don't know if the word is not allowed or just, you know, you just kept them out somehow, right? But cars will be, you know, we have some cars that do terrific business and we do really well with the pickup trucks, with the SUVs. We have some great things. And I think the people of Europe will have some diversification. I think that'll make them happy. So I think maybe cars would be the one that would go the biggest. And the second would be agriculture, the farmers. And we'll do it in very strict conjunction with the president and the European Union. And they're coming into, likewise, they're coming into our country with great vigor. And I think they're going to make a lot of money with this. I think everybody is. I think and again, it's going to bring a lot of unity and friendship. It's going to work out really well.
And what a dictator, right? It's going to bring a lot of unity and friendship. What an authoritarian Donald Trump is, right? Ruling with an iron fist. It's going to bring a lot of unity and friendship between the European Union. Well, that doesn't fit the narrative that the left spins about Trump at all, does it? And as you know, of course, as some, you could hear some female reporter who had an American accent, so somewhere from the United States, probably CNN or MSNBC, some fake news outlet here. What concessions did the United States give up? That was her question to the president of the European Union. Because, of course, we've got to spin this negatively. We can't possibly go out this morning and talk about the fact that the EU is set to invest an additional $600 billion, additional $600 billion to what its current investments are in the United States. That is not a headline that the media wants to spin. That is not a headline that MSNBC, CNN, ABC, CBS, and NBC want to mention. They're always looking for the negative. And as I, you know, look this morning, I've had the cable news networks on since around 4:30 this morning. What are they talking about? Not this. It's mentioned. They'll cover it every once in a while. Little hit here or there. They'll give it, you know, a couple of minutes here and there. But then it's back to all the other negative stuff that they talk about. Because nothing that President Donald Trump does is ever good enough. They don't. These people are not interested in a strong, safe, prosperous America. And that's an important thing to understand when you watch and listen to the media coverage of these, you know, this trade deal with the European Union, or really anything else that the president does. There is no interest in covering good news because these outlets are ideologically not aligned with the president. They're not, I would argue, they're not ideologically aligned with the vast majority of the American people. So any opportunity that they can use to make something seem bad, any opportunity that they can use to try and spin something in a negative light. And again, you heard the question from, it was the second question asked. You know, what concessions did the United States give up? That's, of course, incredibly negative. And, you know, looking at the numbers in this, in 2024, the United States had a goods trade deficit of $235.6 billion with the European Union. That was up 13% from where that number was the year prior in 2023. $235.6 billion. So as you heard from the president of the EU, the starting point on all of this was a significant imbalance, a surplus on the EU side and a deficit on the US side. And so that was the starting point. Those were the starting figures, the starting numbers, and all of the negotiations unfolded from that point. Now, the president has been pretty hell-bent on this trade deficit argument with a variety of countries and PACs like the European Union, is that he is not in favor of and continues to rally against these deficit numbers that exist in large part not in favor of the United States. We take a lot of products from all of these places, China, Vietnam, you know, wherever, and then those products and goods are not as open, not as available in these other markets. And you heard a couple of the examples. For example, American automobiles and auto manufacturing. There's not a whole hell of a lot of American-made cars that are in the EU. And the president, you know, just told reporters, this was last night in the EU, that that is one of the things that he is hoping is now open to American car manufacturers, selling and importing products that are made in the United States into the EU. He talked about trucks and SUVs, which are, you know, predominantly some of the larger and more popular cars that are produced here in the United States. Talked about agriculture, which, if you weren't aware, is the largest industry in the state of North Carolina. Our largest industry is not tech, not pharmaceuticals, not any of that. It's agriculture. It's crops. It's production. It's making and growing goods. That is the largest industry in the state of North Carolina. So further opening the European Union in markets throughout, again, you look at the map of the EU countries, Portugal, Spain, France, Italy, Germany, Poland, Sweden, Finland. You look at these 27 countries that are in the EU being able to import United States grown products into these areas. That's a huge win. And especially for a state like North Carolina, where agriculture is the largest part of our economy, if this goes forward the way that the deal is signed and the way that the plan is was laid out by the president, his trade representatives, the president of the EU and her trade representatives, this should be a big win for the United States. The president says it's the biggest of all deals. And you talk about tough negotiations, You've got 27 different countries in the EU that, as the president noted, all have different industries, all have different strengths and weaknesses. So to come to this overall deal with the EU, which is really 27 very large countries, but we're not talking about small little groups. We're talking about Spain, France, Germany, Ireland, Poland, the Netherlands. These are very large countries. Some of them have very large economies. The fact that this deal was able to be struck, I think, is a huge win for the president. And hopefully a huge win for the United States and not only American consumers, but American producers, especially those in the agricultural industry, in the automobile industry, in the pharmaceutical industry. Major, major wins for the United States. So as the trade deadline continues to loom, as those deals, as we get closer to Friday, which is crazy enough, August the 1st, we're going to hopefully see a couple more of these deals. Again, the rumor this morning is that there is a deal that is pretty close with China, Japan on the brink of a deal as well. So as that continues to unfold in the next couple of days, these countries do not want to deal with these overarching tariffs that are being discussed and being threatened by the United States. We'll see hopefully kind of a shotgun approach to these deals in the next couple of days, and hopefully multiple of them coming in. Again, as the president is going out to the world, to various countries all over the place, and advocating for the United States of America, seems to be a win in all of, at least all of the top line numbers on this deal, purchasing U.S. military goods and opening up parts of the U.S. market. So that is great news. We'll keep an eye on those details, keep an eye on some of those other trade deals throughout the week, and we'll have those details and pass them along to you as soon as we get them. And of course, as they're relevant, right here on the Nick Craig Show. Before we continue this morning, I do want to tell you about one of our great local advertisers and sponsors. That's The Law Group. And I want to let you know that when legal challenges arise, you know, they happen, you make sure to put your trust in The Law Group right here in Wilmington. Since 2003, their experienced attorneys have provided high-quality, affordable legal services across Eastern North Carolina. Whether you're facing a situation like a divorce, navigating a real estate transaction, or maybe you're in a position where you need a strong criminal defense, The Law Group has your back. Their dedicated team ensures your questions are answered and issues are resolved as quickly as possible. Great news, folks. They're located in downtown Wilmington and just a phone call away at 910-251-6088, or you can visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. Give them a call, 910-251-6088, or you can visit their great website, lawgroupnc.com. The Law Group, experience and dedication you can rely on. We appreciate The Law Group and their continued support of the Nick Craig Show. On the other side, a lot of outrage and controversy over the last couple of weeks with the Congress cutting and the president signing into law cuts to public media funding. We were told that NPR and PBS, these stations, were shutting down, going off the air, and well, lo and behold, that hasn't happened. We'll dive into the details here in Wilmington with our local NPR affiliate coming up after this. As the Nick Craig Show rolls on this Monday morning, streaming live on YouTube, Rumble, X, Facebook, and of course, 24/7, wherever you get your podcasts. And a good Monday morning to you. Welcome back to the Nick Craig Show. Hope you had a phenomenal weekend, a hot one across southeastern North Carolina, and the temperatures, well, they continue to be warm over the next couple of days. Once again, an extreme heat warning is in effect for temperatures today, as we'll have the heat index going well over potentially 110 degrees with those high temperatures being felt throughout the area throughout the day today. 96 the high temperature today, and as we head into the middle and latter parts of your work week and well into the month of August, you're going to see those continued high temperatures, 94 Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and then a little bit of a relief as you get into the weekend, 84 Saturday, 84 Sunday, And then as you look into next week, temperatures continue to be in the upper middle 80s and a lower 90s. So hot temperatures, again, continuing isolated chances of showers and storms. We are very much locked into this summertime weather pattern across the southeastern North Carolina as we head into the 1st of August. Make sure if you're spending excessive time outdoors today that you are very well hydrated. And if you can not spend that time outdoors, that is highly recommended with those heat indexes over 110 degrees in some areas. So back a couple of weeks ago, you had Congress cut more than $1.1 billion in funding to the Corporation for Public Broadcasters, CBP. That money was allocated and has been allocated by Congress every year for decades now. And that went to fund, essentially in large part, PBS, the television branch of public media, and NPR, National Public Radio, the radio branch of public media. And this, there has been calls going all the way back to the Reagan administration. You got to go back to the 80s for those essential incentives from the federal government to go away. Bush talked about it. Trump talked about it in his first term, and it actually came to fruition back a couple of weeks ago. Congress slashed the CBP budget. The president signed it into law 2 weeks ago, and now it is in effect. That $1.1 billion that was given from Congress to the Corporation for Public Broadcasters is no more. And we were told that that was going to essentially erase public media. We were told that without that $1.1 billion, which, by the way, did not make up a large fraction of either of their fundings, we were told that that was going to end public media, that American citizens would no longer have access to emergency alerts, that during crisis, during disaster, during hurricanes and flash flooding and tornadoes, that Americans would no longer have access to life-saving critical information. That was the fear-mongering that played out from Washington, D.C. And the point that I have made, and you've probably heard many others make this point, that if NPR and PBS, which no longer operate as public broadcasters, but work as, in large part, mouthpieces of the Democrat Party, it's obvious in the reporting. You don't take my word for it. Take Yuri Berliner's word for it, who spent almost 30 years working at NPR in Washington, D.C. He wrote a great expose last year, back in, I think it was April of last year, on what had happened at NPR. How the entity itself went from a place where individuals would look at both sides of the story, where the reporters and journalists for NPR were intellectually curious as to what was going on. They would dig into the details. They were hard news. They were journalists. And he described the transition that he saw over his lifetime, essentially working at NPR, and why he decided to write the story that he did over at the Free Press last year, back in April. And that story has been well talked about. If you have not read Yuri Berliner's post, if you have not had the opportunity to read directly his words, I would highly encourage you to do so, because it really sets the stage and sets the picture for how NPR, how NPR and PBS, but large part NPR, how they have changed, how they went from a place of being interested in the news, being interested in reporting facts to the American public, into a place where that was not the case anymore, where they were then choosing, well, we need to support and we need to cover news stories and cover topics and interviews and news that was ideologically aligned with us as journalists working for these entities. He described this in great detail. So again, don't take my word for it. When I say that I don't believe that these entities are truly interested in accurate, free information, don't take my word for it. Take his word for it. He spent 30 years working for NPR. I think it's fair to say that he is a subject matter expert in what they do, what they produce, and how they operate. So this has been an ongoing issue, and he described as NPR went through the early 2000s, past 2010, and over the last 10 or 15 years, how he saw the coverage shifting. how they were no longer interested in the actual truth in the story, and how news stories that did not paint Democrats in good lights would in a good light would all of a sudden be not discussed, how they would, you know, maybe obstruct the process in that and maybe leave out key facts and important information, all in an attempt to do exactly what the rest of the vast majority of mainstream media does in the United States, which is provide cover for the political party that they most closely align with. And in the United States, American media, the vast majority of it, of course, there are not everybody, but the vast majority is covering for the Democrat Party. When you look at the NPR newsroom in Washington, D.C., there is not a single registered Republican working at NPR in D.C. And I will make the point, and I think it is a fair assessment, that when you don't have a single person that is a registered Republican working for your entity, I think it is hard-pressed to claim that you are trying to bring out nothing more than the fact. You are not capable of seeing it from the other side of the aisle if you have nobody in your newsroom, if you have nobody that is providing a counterpoint to your issues. That is a problem. That is a serious issue. And so NPR and PBS over the last 10 or 15, 20 years have skewed further and further to the left. They have isolated more and more of their audience. And the end result has been, well, the American taxpayer found themselves incredibly frustrated with what they were seeing, what they were hearing, what they were reading, what they were watching, and said enough was enough. President Donald Trump and Congress followed through on that and cut funding. We were told that these stations were all just going to vanish, that public media would no longer exist. And here at locally, you've got WHQR, that's the NPR affiliate here in Wilmington, and they put this out, and we're doing a pledge drive last week. It says, emergency appeal, public radio funding eliminated. Congress and the president have rescinded $174,000 in previously approved funds for WHQR. That's 8.5% of WHQR's annual budget gone. Help fill the gap, protect your public radio station, and fuel the future of critical fact-based journalism, classical music, and emergency broadcasting for the Cape Fear with your gift right now. So last Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, NPR here in Wilmington at WHQR held a pledge drive, like they do multiple times a year, where they are asking their audience, asking the people that enjoy their content, enjoy what they produce, for money. And lo and behold, what happened? As of 4 p.m. on Friday, the pledge drive ended at 5 o'clock, NPR here in Wilmington, WHQR, had raised $169,950, which is great. I'm glad they were able to raise that money. And I'm glad that the United States taxpayer, specifically those taxpayers here in southeastern North Carolina, no longer have to foot this bill. The point that has been brought up time and time again, and I will reiterate again this morning, is that if people support what NPR is doing, if they support what PBS is doing, they have the opportunity to financially support it, the same way that the great audience here financially supports what I'm doing. We've got our great group of members over at Patreon, patreon.com/Nick Craig, that support the show financially every month. We've got our great advertisers like the Law Group here in Wilmington that support the show financially and allow me to do this each and every weekday morning. And I'm incredibly grateful for them. This is the new model. This is one of the ways in which media is transitioning. If you have an audience of people that enjoy what you're doing, appreciate the information that you're bringing to light or the information that you're providing, they can, and in large part, do support that. That's exactly how NPR and PBS should be funded going forward. It's a large part of how they were already funded. And it is obviously clear this morning with the success that the local NPR affiliate, WHQR, had Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of last week that they didn't need the $174,000 from Congress that they were getting every year. There was enough support. there is enough audience, there are enough listeners and readers online that support WHQR's content to allow it to continue. And that's great. That's good. That's exactly how this process was and is going to unfold in the long term. If there is a group of people that are supporting what you're doing, they will fund it. And that was the argument from the early discussion of this earlier this year. Is that why is Congress, why is the American taxpayer funding journalism that is not at this point fair and straight down the middle? These stations have large enough members, a membership, have a large enough audience to fund this themselves. And I'm glad that they do. I've made the point. I'll make it one more time. I do not want to see local NPR affiliates go away. I do not want to see PBS North Carolina vanish from the airwaves. But I also don't want to pay for it anymore. They are not providing the public service that they claim that they are. Do they provide emergency alerts? Absolutely. So does every other freaking radio and television station on the air in southeastern North Carolina and throughout the vast majority of the United States. They all fund that at their own expense and at their own dime. They don't get any money from Congress. They don't get any money from FEMA. They don't get any money from the FCC to fund emergency broadcasts. They don't get any funding to provide emergency alerts to to their audience, to their listeners or their viewers. They do that as a public service because that's how they operate. Oh, those alerts go out regardless of whether PBS and NPR exist. And so the same way that private media entities have to go out and get advertisers to support their message, the same way that conservative radio stations have to go out and find advertisers, find companies that support the message and purchase advertising, that's the same way that NPR and PBS need to exist. And so for all of the outrage, all of the hell being raised by those on the political left that these individual stations were just going to vanish from the airwaves tomorrow turned out to be complete and total BS. NPR here in Wilmington, WHQR, raised the money. They raised over $169,000, close to $170,000 over 3 days. They've got a large enough audience where they can generate that money. That is great. That is good. And going forward, that's how they're going to be funded. If you support that kind of media, if that's what you're interested in listening to and what you're interested in reading and watching, great. I don't care what news sources you watch. I don't care what you listen to. I don't believe that radio and TV stations should be shut down because I don't believe in them. I don't believe that people should be silenced because their political opinion differs from mine. There's the quintessential difference between the right and the left. The left, it was all for cancel culture, right? Somebody says something that they disagree with, and what do? They go after their advertisers. They go after their family. They go after their jobs. They cancel these individuals because they're not interested in free speech. They're not interested in opposing viewpoints. They're not interested in individuals having intellectual discussions and conversations on issues. When somebody disagrees with them, they shut them down. When somebody disagrees with them, they want them run out of town. They want them banned from Facebook, banned from Twitter, barred from being able to have a job, own a home. They want these people destroyed and ruined. I don't want that. I'm not happy that Stephen Colbert lost his job. That sucks. I'm not happy that the 100 plus people that worked on that show apparently each and every day are losing their jobs. That sucks. But the media landscape is changing. The show was losing $40 million a year. Wasn't sustainable. So a business decision was made. I'm happy that WHQR was able to raise $169,000 Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And I'm glad that I no longer have to foot that bill. I'm glad that I no longer have to fund what I will describe in large part, not all of it, but in large part, left-wing viewed media that comes out of entities like NPR affiliates all across the country. Not all of it, but I've read enough of it. I've read enough of it for years to understand and know and read and see the left-wing lean, the left-wing bend that exists in many of the coverages that come out of NPR. Hunter Biden laptop didn't exist. You didn't hear it on NPR. Donald Trump, the China virus came from Wuhan. Nope, didn't exist. NPR wouldn't tell you about it. So it's not independent journalism, fair and public media. Nonsense. It's no different than any of the rest of the mainstream media that has an ideological bend and an ideological tilt. So if you have people that want to support that, bravo, support it. That's exactly what they did, and I'm glad. So I guess here in southeastern North Carolina, the hand-wringing, the pearl-clutching over how this media was just going to vanish from the airwaves thanks to Donald Trump in Congress once again proved to be ridiculous outrage not based in any fact or any reality. So good for them. Glad that their audience backed up and supported them. That's the way that media is transitioning. That's how NPR and PBS have continued to operate for the last couple of decades, is with support from corporate sponsors and by individuals that enjoy their programs and their shows. Great. That's the model. That's how it works. So that's the latest here with the disastrous removal of funds, the disastrous cuts in funding to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Speaking of supporting the show, coming up Wednesday night, our Nick Craig Show monthly Zoom hangout will be happening. That's July the 30th, a couple of days right before the turn of the month, 7 p.m. on Zoom for those that support the show over at patreon.com/Nick Craig, either a $5, $10 a month or a custom amount. You'll get access to that Zoom link. Check your email inbox or your Patreon account coming up a little bit later on today. You'll see that link in there. 7 o'clock, we'll get together. A lot of news expected here this week in North Carolina. Senate race, a lot of discussions going on there. All of that will unfold 7 p.m. Wednesday night as the Nick Craig Show monthly hangout continues, thanks to our great supporters over at patreon.com/Nick Craig. As always, look forward to chatting with everybody coming up Wednesday night. Once again, thanks to the law group here in Wilmington for their continued support. Give them a call, 910-251-6088, or visit their website online at lawgroupnc.com. That's going to do it for a Monday edition of the Nick Craig Show. Thanks for joining us live, 7 a.m., YouTube, Rumble, X, and Facebook, and of course, 24/7, wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great Monday.